You're listening to Spellbound. Welcome to episode 17 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. You can still listen to it everywhere else you typically listen to podcasts, but check out CastBox and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app on both iOS and Android. I'm really excited about today's episode because we're going to be doing a little debate, a debate about civilization and technology and whether or not they are positive forces. And we're doing this not because we're completely and utterly insane, although that might be a contributing factor. We're doing it because I picked up John Zerzan's new book. It's called A People's History of Civilization, and it's all about how civilization's roots go back to the origins of agriculture, patriarchy, and it keeps people at odds with each other, erodes community, and puts the world's resources to work in an unhealthy way. And whether or not you agree with John's perspective on these ideas, it's definitely educational and interesting to read. And I highly recommend you check out his book. And he is joining us today now for the second time on the podcast, John Zerzan, and he will be defending the position of primitivism and anarchy. And I guess people should know John has no cell phone, no credit card, and had no car up until very recently. Now he has one that he shares with his wife, and his only phone is a landline that's bugged by the government. So he's an interesting guy. And is definitely qualified to defend the position of anarchy in this debate. On the flip side of the debate, we've got Andrew Rader, very successful aerospace engineer, has a PhD in long-duration spaceflight from MIT, is the author of numerous books, and is an all-around technocratic kind of guy. He's excited about the future and is very involved in solving its obstacles. His new book, which is coming out soon, is A Timeline of Civilization Through the Lens of Exploration and Where That's Leading Us into the Future and onto different planets. So this should be an interesting debate, and I'm excited about jumping in. Thank you guys for being here.
Cool.
Great. Yeah, looking forward to it.
So Andrew, what were your thoughts on the episode I did with John last week?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there is definitely this trade-off. So I think everything in life is a trade-off, and you have to put the pros and cons on each side of the scale and see where it comes out. And I think that John has some really valid criticisms of civilization. Some of them are civilization in general, and some of them are maybe today's society or, you know, the type of society we live in, but not necessarily applicable to all of civilization. So I think that he has some pretty good critiques. He goes through chapter by chapter and lays those out. And a lot of them are really valid. So there's actually a fair degree of common ground, I think, that exists between John and myself. I think we just sort of draw a different overall conclusion as a result of it. So we could maybe step through some of the chapters. That might be a good way to start.
But maybe we should start with some of the common ground. Maybe that would be a good. Yeah, like to hear your thoughts on what you guys actually have in common first.
Right. So I think we both agree that agriculture created civilization. I think we both probably agree it's the most important, maybe, discovery in the history of humanity. So it had the greatest change in our lives. I think we also agree that civilization created a hierarchical power structure, laws and rulers and things like that, ways to live together, because civilization means living with strangers. In hunter-gatherer societies, you have bands of people who all know each other, maybe 100 people, something like that. But as soon as you start putting people into cities, you're living with people you don't know. So you need to have ways of living with them. And that often does mean some element of control. In all civilizations and societies, there's kind of this trade-off between control and freedom, right? And security also. This is something that comes up a lot in the United States today. Security versus freedom. So, you know, we all want to be safe, but we don't want people telling us what to do. But you have to have some kinds of laws and order, I think, to govern the behavior of people living together. And that's what agriculture created. So I think that I would say that John makes a lot of valid points in his book. He goes through and picks out some really interesting examples. And I think he has a pretty good grasp of history. I really enjoyed his First World War chapter, World War One chapter, for example, where he talks about the causes of the war. And but the way I guess I see it is he's pointing out throughout history all these negative aspects of civilization, but I don't think he's maybe appreciating some of the positive aspects of civilization. So I think it's a little bit maybe one-sided that we're picking out all the bad things and then we're saying, let's just burn the whole thing down, which is something I definitely don't agree with. And I think that the advantages of civilization outweigh the negative aspects of it and the community. We could talk about all these different aspects of it, but like, so I'll go through like a list of things that I think are positives of civilization.
Well, before we go there, I'd like to give John a chance to respond to everything you just said. John, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think he puts it very well. I mean, that's that kind of overview. It's we would both subscribe to that, the general picture. It seems like what it's about, I suppose, very largely is what is the future of it? What is the train or the thread of it? What does it lead to? What is it, you know, what is it producing? And what is it taking away, as he was about to imply? That's a question of you have to pay a cost for various things, and then you decide whether that's a legitimate bargain. Of course, all that takes place, I would say, that takes place in the context of settling for the whole logic of civilization, which is basically, you know, domestication, as he agreed. And that's where I think it gets more scary. I mean, look at the crisis that we have overall. I mean, every civilization so far has collapsed, has failed. And now there's only one. I think there's only one. There are different cultures, right? But there's only one totalizing, globalizing one, the unitary, you know, technology and capital. And that's everywhere, everywhere. So how's it doing? Well, it's I think it's a disaster. Yeah. And there are things that all of us use and get satisfaction from, the various compensations or the things that you do get. We all need them. We all, that's part of being human, I think. I mean, which, again, there you do get down to at what cost. You know, these consolations, there are some, obviously, you know, music, art, a bunch of things. But at the same time, the general picture, of course, I would say it isn't a good picture. It's not. We lived for a couple of million years without these things, without culture, and we weren't destroying the planet. We didn't have wars and all the rest of it, and we had a face-to-face way of dealing with each other, which I think is the only really valid form of society, and now we don't have it. Maybe I could stick in here something that sure jumps to mind, you know, given Andrew's aerospace background, and that is, this is always taken as a wonderful sort of icon. I'm talking about the photo that the astronauts took of the Earth from the moon, you know, and that has enlivened countless environmental posters. You know, look at our delicate, endangered planet in space, you know, the sphere, and we need to take care of it, blah, blah, blah. Well, and that's all dandy. It's an incredible picture, isn't it? I mean, it can be inspiring and a reminder of what's at stake. At the same time, you know, what's kind of left out of that is, what does it take to get that picture? What does it take to get to the moon? What is it? You know, it involves a massive planetary industrialization, which is destroying the biosphere. We have this catastrophe already arriving, right, in terms of species extinction. The seas are rising and acidifying and warming. The global air is being more and more contaminated. You know, on and on and on. Like, you know, we could both probably go for half an hour on that, right? Well, so it's not just a lovely photo that we can rhapsodize about or worry about or whatever. You know, how do you get that picture?
So I hear you both saying is there's trade-offs for everything. I hear you both saying that.
Well, but if the trade-off is the end of the biosphere, I mean, what kind of trade-off is that? It just seems like that's the worst bargain ever conceived of, which is why that famous quote of Jared Diamond in the 80s, agriculture is the worst mistake in human history. Worst turning point. We're off on this path. Well, look where it's brought us. Yeah, we've got smartphones. We got this and that. And we could talk about technology more specifically too. You know, the technology, well, we're all connected now, instantaneous. We've never been so isolated. We've never been so adrift. There's never been such a zero point of community, if you will. It empowers us. No, it doesn't. We've never been so disempowered.
Andrew's prepared some things that I guess are kind of responses to your book, John. A list of positive things about civilization and agriculture. Andrew, you want to go ahead and share?
Yeah, well, okay. So first of all, I should say, I think there are a lot of problems today. Maybe we should start by addressing that. There are a lot of problems today. And, you know, environmental degradation and global warming and those types of things, they are important problems. Some of the most important problems we face today. I don't think that necessarily results in complete catastrophe for our civilization. The other thing is, every civilization has failed, is what John said. And that's only true to a degree. I think Rome is still with us, for example. We adopted the best practices of Rome. Our global civilization, and I agree with John that there is just one now civilization, essentially. There's some variants around the world. But it sort of has evolved from previous civilizations. We didn't kind of destroy the whole thing. Like even Rome being, you know, torn down by the barbarians, it didn't really happen that way. That's how Gibbons describes it in Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. But that's not really correct. What happened was the barbarians came in and they wanted to be Roman. And the Franks and the Visigoths, they adopted Roman ways. And, you know, medieval Europeans basically considered themselves to be Romans. That's why you have the Holy Roman Empire. You have the word Tsar, the Caesar and Kaiser. They're all derived from Rome. Napoleon tried to recreate Rome. The U.S. tried to recreate Rome. That's why you have Roman symbology all over the United States government. We are still Rome. I think Rome still exists. It's just that civilization evolves over time. We take the best ideas. It's just like species. Every species that ever existed is now extinct. Every single one. Except for the ones that are currently alive today, which is less than 1% of all the species that have ever existed. Every star and planet that came before us is now gone. You know, this is the nature of the universe. It's changed, it's birth and death. And that's what happens to species. Every species is gone. Every person who ever lived is gone. And civilizations, they may fall. The question is whether it leads to the inevitable, you know, destruction of our civilization. I don't think I agree with that. And then what happens after? If you have like some catastrophe to our civilization, we effectively go back to scrounging and becoming basically hunter-gatherers. So, you know, if that is really the next step, it could be that. Or it could be that our civilization does meet its end and then some other life form may evolve to fill that niche. And there was a really interesting story about rats, how rats are going to survive the nuclear apocalypse and then evolve to become intelligent species of rats to fill every ecological niche on the planet, right?
This sounds like an origin story for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles something.
I should say, the question is, what is your goal here, right? So is your goal to maximize human happiness? Is that the goal? And then the question is your goal to maximize...
Whose goal?
Well, look, so we're talking about the relative benefits and costs of civilization.
Right.
To what end? Like, what is the achieved desire? Like, let's say we could do whatever we want with civilization. There are no consequences. Right now, today, we can press a button and do whatever we want. What is the goal? Are we going to try to maximize human happiness? Are we going to try to maximize average happiness? So, you know, we have a hunter-gatherer world of 10 million people. That's, you know, maybe the carrying capacity of Earth is much, much lower with hunter-gatherers. So we're going to have 10 million people who are, on average, you know, happier than they are today, which I actually don't think is the case either. But let's assume John is right that hunter-gatherers were happier. Is our goal to, you know, create an Earth of 10 million hunter-gatherers who are happy, or have a 7 billion people on Earth who, on average, are maybe slightly less happy? But I also don't think that it's true that, you know, on average, most people around Earth today are depressed. And I also think we exaggerate our problems to some extent. Environmental problems are definitely serious, but I think there may be technological solutions, and I know how John feels about that. But, you know, I think some of the problems that we talk about are way overblown, because this goes back to the first podcast we did about negative news, why negative news sells and why we hear about it, because our brains are conditioned to, you know,
respond to fear,
in bad information, right? So, like, let's talk about violent deaths, right? Shootings. We have mass shootings in America. Okay, so first of all, I think that's a problem more of America than of civilization.
You know, we're getting maybe a little ahead of ourselves here. Yeah. Let's start with some of the good things that you wrote down about civilization.
So
let's
civilization, start with the positive benefits. We have many more people. Obviously, I think John would agree that 7 billion people couldn't be supported as hunter-gatherers. So we have many more people on Earth today, and I think they are living relatively happy lives. I'm not going to, you know, weigh my finger on whether they're happier than hunter-gatherers. I think maybe they're actually. I think they're equally happy, because I think happiness is genetic. So I think that, you know, people living in squalor are definitely less happy. So poverty does create unhappiness, but there's a lot less poverty than there ever was today. And I think that, you know, hunter-gatherer or sort of an average person today are probably about equally happy, because your happiness is not dependent on your external surroundings. It's actually intrinsic. We have far less violence today. It's a lot less dangerous, and we have far less scarcity today than we did as hunter-gatherers. And I think that's something John would probably disagree with.
Okay, so let's stop at this third one here after you do this and let John respond to these three. So you've got violence. What was the first one?
First one was many more people.
Oh, many more people. Okay, and then you've got... So the first...
And you might argue whether that's a benefit. I think you could definitely argue from a utilitarian perspective it is a benefit to have more people.
So we've got happiness due to population. We've got less violence. And what's your third one?
Science, reason, all the technologies we've invented. So I think there's some fundamental benefit of science because it lets us understand the world. Like, we wouldn't be having this conversation today. We're using microphones. We're using, you know, Skype and talking across a distance. We're communicating, connecting across the distance, right? So I think there's some fundamental benefit to our technology. The other thing is, you know, it's the exploration of truth. What is the world? If we were hunter-gatherers, we'd make up mythological stories around the campfire about how thunder and lightning were created, right? But we're not. And we actually have the tools now through civilization, through technology, to understand the universe. And this is the first time it's ever happened, as far as we know, in the history of the entire universe. What is the purpose of life? What's the purpose of the universe? We don't really know, but it's kind of remarkable that for the first time ever, we can actually look introspectively and understand who we are, where we came from, and what our place is in the universe. And for the first time, the universe has a brain that can actually, you know, fathom that and appreciate the fact that we exist. I mean, I'm not saying hunter-gatherers wouldn't appreciate the fact that they exist, but we can kind of understand it from a perspective of truth.
So, John, how would you respond to those three? We've got increased population being a positive because it creates happiness, and then we've got decreased violence, and then we've got technology and science, which I'm sure you probably would have some interesting things to say about technology. And then it looks like Andrew's going to
I wouldn't say increased population creates happiness at all.
Okay.
In fact, possibly the opposite. But it depends how you measure happiness and whether you're talking about maximizing the sum of happiness or the average
happiness. You're saying that there's more people on the planet, and so like our ability to sustain life is increasing or something.
Well, that is definitely true. There's many ways to look at this, but basically, if you're trying to maximize happiness, what is the goal of life? Basically, it depends what you think the purpose of life is. But if you think that there's some benefit to humans living happy lives, and you have more humans, then
yeah, no, I don't think many people would agree with that. I think it's a totally unnatural population growth, and we know two hinge points that have created that. First of all, was domestication, relatively, not in absolute numbers, because it wasn't giant numbers, but it was a spike. And then the more recent one, of course, is 250 years ago, industrialization, which was the spike in absolute numbers that drove the population to what I would say is now insane levels, completely unsustainable levels. 7 billion people, and soon it'll be 20 billion or so. I mean, if you think that's a natural, wonderful phenomenon, that you don't have to be a primitivist to question that. I mean, come on. Why do you think that it was stable for 2 million years, basically? Because we were not intoxicated with control and domestication and pushing all these things along as fast as we could. You know, and I think, you know, the question of violence, well, that's Pinker makes a lot of the question of relative violence. If you've got billions of people, you know, in a way, it's there's fewer violence given how many people there are. But if you've got all these cops and armies and everything else to enforce that, well, that doesn't prove anything. It just proves that the control mechanisms, which keep growing by the day, like now we have total surveillance. We have zero privacy at the peak of civilization, which I'd say is pretty much synonymous with the peak of technology. And, you know, this whole question of happiness is, of course, very elusive. It's very, we don't know what the consciousness of people was way back when. We certainly don't. In fact, it's very hard to define it right now, as I think you were suggesting. But look at how much anxiety and depression and so forth there is. I mean, the number of people taking drugs is incredibly high in this most developed country, right? Legal drugs and illegal drugs to maintain some semblance of what we might call happiness, or at least, you know, some kind of equanimity of some kind. Well, that's not a happy picture. That's not a healthy picture. That's kind of an insanely unhealthy picture. You know, that's, and you brushed by the question of shootings, and you're right to say that so far, this is much more a question of U.S. culture and society than anywhere else. But I think it's spreading, and it's not just it, you know, it's roughly speaking a function of technology. You look at the most technological societies, and here I come to what I think is very, very central, and maybe we still have to try to figure out how to define it, but community. Community to me is absolutely at the core of all of this. Well, you don't have any community when mass society takes over. And that's kind of, I think that's hard to refute. You don't have real community where people are accountable, when they take responsibility, when they are active agents in what kind of society they have, what kind of solutions to problems that come up they have. You don't have that in mass society. You have to pick up the phone and call this or that expert or cop or whatever to come in and solve things. You don't even have the room to be an actor, to be part of the community. You're not. You're just a number. You know, when that happens, when you get to that place, people are adrift. They're the social solidarity or social bonds or however you want to call it, that's pretty much gone. So it's an emptiness. It's an anomie that just keeps deepening to the point where somebody who didn't show any kind of symptoms or craziness or crime or anything else walks down to the mall and kills 20 people. You think that's happiness? And science, let's just look at that for a second. Science, or why don't I just call it reason? We have these heights of reason now. Well, reason isn't any more neutral than technology. Reason, as very many people have put it, is basically now it's instrumental reason. It's reason to produce something, to extend the control mechanism, which is domestication. It's not some abstract thing. It's not. It's fully involved in values and choices. That isn't some completely clean, neutral thing at all. And that's why people make this illusion of failing to look at the photo from the moon, and instead of feeling rapture about it, are thinking, what the fuck? You know what it costs to get this photo from the moon? Do you see this planet in its almost death throes already? We're getting to that place. Doesn't everybody know that?
Yeah, before I turn it over to Andrew, John, I'd like to hear you respond to the last point that Andrew made about your perspective on technology and the fact that we would not even be able to be here having this conversation right now if it weren't for...
Well, that's true. That's obvious. And I'm glad that we have this chance. But again, at what cost? And, you know, when Andrew says, well, sure, you know, come on, we have problems. Everybody knows there are problems, but, you know, we're working on it. We have reason. We have all these wonderful scientific things. Well, my point there is a simple one. Yeah, we have problems. Where did they come from? And what is going to be the answer to that? I find it really bizarre, really ironic that the technology, in a general sense, which has created all these problems, from cancer to you name it, then comes around and says, well, if only we have more of this, then we'll solve the problem. And we're not supposed to notice that it has created the problem. That's not the answer. It's just not the answer. It's the problem. So to say, oh, we're doing fine, you know, we're working on all these problems, and look at our marvelous science. Really?
Right. So I guess I would say that violence and environmentalism, war, these things are not products of civilization so much as products of humanity. Humans, along with chimpanzees, are the only animals who actually engage in war with each other. They go out and form bands. You know, hunter-gatherers had war. I think
no, they didn't.
They absolutely did.
There is no evidence. There is no evidence at all of organized violence.
Yes, there absolutely
is. That's anthropology 101. I can't let you just say that's true. That's not true. That is a function of complexity and domestication. I mean, they didn't even have the wherewithal to have war, and they didn't seem to want to have the wherewithal to raise armies and have organized violence. That comes much, much later. That's a very recent development. And there have been these people that have tried to prove that, and they have all failed. I can cite the books where they're actually talking about, when they talk about primitive peoples, every one of those primitive peoples, so-called, are domesticators. Okay, they're not hunter-gatherers. They have already gotten involved in domestication. That's when you have the violence.
So let me ask this, Andrew, what evidence do you have that there was organized violence in hunter-gatherer times?
Right. So it depends what we call war. I would actually agree with John that something, you know, as defined as war, where we have armies and, you know, set out in paper peace treaties and let's break this peace treaty and go out and fight these people and take their crops and stuff. Or war is, to some extent, a product of civilization. I do agree with that. However, lower level violence of sort of gangs going together and forming and going and trying to take territory and resources and mates from each other, that definitely is endemic to humanity. It's endemic to our closest ancestor, chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are the only other animal that we know of that goes out and forms bands, and they go out and hunt and kill each other. And we look at primitive civilizations, and they have, or primitive societies rather, who are not civilizations, and they have violent death rates that are 10 times higher than ours. Like the homicide rate in the United States is like 6 per 100,000, whereas a primitive society is 300, you know, and it varies. And some are more peaceful than others. Actually, some of the ones that John pointed to in his book actually are the more relatively peaceful ones. But there's others that are much more violent. And I think the average works out to something like 300. And it's also true that that may not be a reflective sample.
I don't know your source for that, because that's very much disputed. Just like the thing about everyone was dead by 30. There's a lot of these things that are still passed around and are really baloney. They're not very true at all. And if you break these down and really take a close look, a lot of that evaporates. So you're trying to get away with just saying, well, people always killed each other. Well, that happens not to be true. There was violence. I'm not saying there was no violence. There were predatory animals. There were all kinds of things. You know, there were accidents. There was a rather high child or infant mortality rate millions of years ago or thousands of years ago. But that's what is used to skew this whole picture about how everybody was dead by 20 or 30 or 40 or whatever fiction you choose. It's really not true. They lived as long as we do if they got past infant thing. And I'm not saying it was wonderful that a lot of infants didn't survive, but you got to really sort it out and look at the literature. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, that humans are innately violent or something. You know, that doesn't hold water.
So we're looking right now at an article in Science, for example, and I have a number of about a dozen other articles that looked at hunter-gatherer war. I just read one this morning from The Economist. It suggests that hunter-gatherers went to war and had extremely high violent death rates. And, you know, we look at skeletons.
Well, so who I mean, wrote that? So. That's crap. That's
John,
not true.
I mean, it is. This is one of the concerns I had, is that we're just not going to agree on the fundamental data. And,
well,
you know,
you
on this topic, it leaves us at an impasse.
If you can't back them up, if you don't have the evidence, if you can't, I mean, then you just keep repeating stuff that I will just say, that's not true. If you look into it more deeply, you'll find it's not true.
Well, understood. So I agree that that is not a particularly productive line.
John, what evidence do you have that that hunter-gatherers did not go to war?
Where's the physical evidence in favor of it? There's a lot of things that are just like megafauna extinction. Every time there were humans, well, they just killed off all the large mammals. No, that isn't true. I mean, you can say that, and that's the long-standing sort of comic book figure of caveman or something, but it's far from accurate. You know, there's a closet load of these things, and there's a big gap between the what is accepted, what is the unanimous orthodox views in the literature, in ethnography, anthropology, pretty much, and then these other things that still obtain, and then you still get them repeated all the time. For example, here's one. I challenge anyone to find something that counters this. Hunter-gatherer life was typified by egalitarianism, by sharing, period, full stop. That's just the orthodox thing. I used to say that in talks as part of, you know, talks I would give. And some people would go, what, you know, what? And time after time, I would run into people later and they'd say, I'm taking a course in anthropology. And the teacher said exactly what you said. And they would just stand and kind of stare at me as if I was making it up.
No, can I respond
to
that? I actually agree with you there.
You're talking about community and happiness.
Oh, I agree with you there.
I think sharing and egalitarianism, which totally doesn't exist anymore, right?
I don't necessarily totally agree with that, but I do agree with you that hunter-gatherer societies were far more egalitarian than civilizations, and especially early agricultural societies. I agree with that. However, there are some downsides to community, as you say. And the reason why they were more egalitarian is because they lived in bands of relatives. They were essentially families. Families share things. As soon as you're living with strangers, it's hard to share things because you can't trust them, and there's no genetic, you know, basis for doing so.
Once again, the latest literature... And we all assumed that that was right, but they're not. It isn't right. They weren't relatives. That kind of, again, a somewhat surprising thing, but the genetic evidence kind of disavows that. And I don't know why or how. I mean, I'm just kind of, I would say, a kind of pleasant surprise that it didn't depend on the genealogy, on the well, that's my cousin. I can't kill my cousin. No, they were very much a mixed bag. And that hasn't been refuted.
It doesn't seem that crazy to me that you know, I'm listening to all this. I'm no expert on either side of this argument, but just listening to it, it doesn't seem that crazy to me that hunter-gatherers would have had some kind of incentive to go to war or to fight each other at certain times, especially if they were like traveling and, you know, they're exhausting resources in one area and then moving on to the next. If that's part of your life and you're settling down somewhere in an area that has a bunch of food to eat, and then another tribe comes in and they want to eat it, it doesn't seem that crazy that the people who are already inhabiting that area would be like, hey, get the hell out of here and start fighting over it.
Well, yeah, and you do see that. That comes at a certain stage. That comes basically with private property, with domestication, because if you have way fewer people, you're not just traveling around exhausting the resources. That's just not the way it works. The counter to domestication is taking what nature gives. And domestication is the opposite. You are extorting nature. You are making the earth work. That's when you're exhausting the resources, and that's when the population starts going up a great deal. So, you know, it's two different realities. After a while, though, you do have competition for resources, especially with agriculture. People do the work. They do the weeding. They do whatever it is to, and then somebody comes along who hasn't done that work, starts taking the vegetables or fruit or whatever it is, and the person who did all the work says, hey, get off, you know, get back here, and they build a fence, and, you know, you have private property, and that's really when you get that sort of thing. And it's, you know, you could say it's understandable. That guy or that group did all this work, and then somebody traveling along just going to come and rob it all, right? So, yeah, there's a logic to that, but it's, you know, again, it has so much to do with domestication setting in.
Okay, we're going to let Andrew respond to that, and then we're going to move on to the other points that we have to talk about so we don't spend too much time on this one. What did you have to say about that, Andrew?
Oh, well, no, it is true that there's more incentive to defend territory if you have to live in one place and grow your crops there and you put the work in. So John's somewhat right about that. I think that there is more war. I don't think it's more organized in a civilization. I definitely agree with that. But you do have, you know, there's less protections as well. In a civilization, you have rules and you have armies partly to protect you from the roving bands, right? Because if you don't have that, you could get just clubbed by some other hunter-gatherer who wants to take this water hole or take this tree that you've discovered or this carcass that you've just killed. So I think there's a difference between war and violence.
Well, that's the ideology. That's still the case today. From the early cities, you know, you got the walls and the masters were saying, you better not go out there. That's all treacherous and dangerous.
Well, sure, it's
killed.
A bargain.
You got to stay here where
bargain.
The cops can protect you.
Government but is a security course, bargain. There's no question about that. Yeah. We trade some freedom for some security. And I think that most people would agree that that is a positive trade-off that works in our favor.
Well, most people, yeah. More people go along with the police state right now because they're scared, because there's all this fear. Terrorists are going to get you. That's been the case all throughout. That's not new.
No, absolutely.
That's
I agree with that.
It's not new
yeah.
whatsoever. It's a way to control people. To dominate people, to surveil them, and everything else. It's a nasty fucking thing. It's not some natural state. Oh, what a wonderful deal!
I think you're expressing it as if there's some mastermind behind all of this, kind of trying to control people, which is not. It's organic. It's this is the result of a lot of people working together.
Well, I'm not a conspiracy person, but it's a lot. There's a logic to it. There's an undeniable course of it and how it works. I'm not saying it's a plot by, you know, a certain cabal of nasty people. I mean, nasty people rise to the to the top because of it. But yeah, no, it's a deeper process. It wasn't just, some conspiracy. No, I'm not saying that.
Right. Okay. No, it's just some of the language you use is maybe polarizing. For example, environmentalism. So I think that civilization is actually a product of humans being destructive to the environment to a large degree, because we became really good hunter-gatherers. We invented fire and better traps and nets and better ways to hunt animals. And it's also true that gathering accounts for more, but we had more people and we started stripping the resources. The Middle East is where agriculture started, but it started independently around 6 or 7, depending on how you measure it, different places. And to a large extent, the agriculture might have started because people were starving because they had stripped the environment, because I think that they did come in. You see the megafauna extinctions as soon as humans enter a region, like North America lost all its giant animals. We had all the horses.
I'm sorry. We're both being polarizing here, but that's just not the way it happened. It wasn't, everything was stripped away, so therefore people had to farm. That's just not the case. Even the sort of right-wing people in the literature have not been able to establish that, because it wasn't the case. And before the unnatural rise in population, there was plenty for everybody, basically speaking. You didn't drive people into the deserts or the polar regions the way, the surviving indigenous people now are. Basically, the only place they have left is the place that domestication didn't want, right? So some of these things can be sorted out. We can, to some degree, agree on the evidence and what does it support. What does it not support? That's the way you have to go on these things.
I don't think that's true. I think that, for example, you're talking about hunter-gatherers not encroaching on each other's territory and not driving each other out, but that's not true at all, actually. So, for example, North America was settled 14,000 years ago, we think. Could have been earlier, maybe, but anyway, people arrived here for the first time 14,000 years ago. Maybe they were settled for a long time. And the first colonizers from Eurasia, advanced technologically, colonizers were actually hunter-gatherers. They were the Inuit. The Inuit came 2,000 years before Europeans ever arrived. They crossed from the Bering Strait into Alaska, and they had what we would call today primitive technology. In fact, they ate pretty much only meat. And they drove out the Dorset people. They drove out the earlier hunter-gatherers who were there. They essentially eradicated them. Maybe they intermixed with them a little bit, but they completely displaced them.
We can't, once again, maybe what you're getting at, I'm not putting words in your mouth here, but there was definitely domestication before the European invaders. I would never be stuck with the fact that it was only contact that ruined everything. I would not say that, because there was a lot of domestication and complexity before Europeans arrived, okay? But the thing is, I'm saying that it's domestication that's so very often the fundamental problem, not any other forms of conflict or competition.
Well, I think that's ascribing a judgment to it. I don't really understand why you think it's better to just, as you say, take what the earth gives us than actually figure out how to, grow foods for ourselves. I think that's kind of empowering, for one thing. The other thing is, are you characterizing the Inuit as a hunter?
7 billion people, that's the way to go.
Well, yeah, if we have 7 billion people sharing ideas, I mean, the more people, that's what the internet is. I mean, the internet's all about sharing ideas. You have more people working together, specialization of resources.
The worldwide grid is just part of this whole destructive cancer of civilization.
Yeah, that's certainly your choice. And I agree that technology has some destructive impacts, like social media. You can get too wrapped up in it. Internet, you do need to escape.
Well, that's just details. It's more fundamental, I'd say. It's not just that. It's the very nature of it, as Heidegger and many others have pointed out. We can talk about how these tech corporations try to perfect addictive forms of it. Yeah, that's all true and that's all horrible, but that's not really the problem. It's way deeper than that.
We've got to move on from this question in honor of time. So let's do this. Let's finish your list of positive things about civilization, Andrew. Let's just go through them real quickly without too much specificity. And then I want to move on and talk about whether or not technology is as destructive of a force as we think it is, and whether or not technology will ever be able to offset its environmental costs. But we'll finish your list of positives about civilization first.
I mean, that was pretty much my list, but I think they're pretty fundamental.
Yeah,
more people means more sharing ideas, which, I think this comes down to how you value progress, how you value science. Like, where in life, in the universe, do we ascribe value? I mean, clearly John ascribes value, I think, not to put words in his mouth, but with connection with sort of a very primitive interaction between humans, something like that. Whereas I just don't think that's the only way you can value progress or value the universe, you know? So what is our goal? And I think that there is some fundamental value in being able to understand the universe and seeking out truth and having, yeah, lots of people on Earth sharing ideas. And I think, you know, population growth is a huge problem, but as people become more affluent, as you know, Japan, Germany, Europe, these countries all have negative growth rates. They're actually losing people because as people become more able to take care of themselves and provide food for themselves, then they don't have as many children. They actually have fewer children than it takes to replace them. So, and this you see this curve all over the place. And, you know, Nigeria, for example, is in a massive population explosion and will probably pass the United States in population and is smaller than Texas. I mean, that's a huge problem. But when societies actually catch up to kind of the Western level of technology, they actually start to decline in technology, or in population rather.
John, why don't you talk about your perspective of technology? Because it's clear that you think a certain extent is acceptable because we're sitting here talking over the internet. So, I mean, why don't you share what your perspective on technology is in relation to the environment?
Okay, well, you know, Andrew makes a consistent point about sharing ideas and how wonderful it is, even if there are 7 billion people. Well, sharing ideas, you know, if we unpack that a little bit, yeah, sharing ideas, so long as they don't challenge the basic reality is the way I would put it. You know, let's face it, what are the ideas that get a fair play or really any accessibility in terms of media? They're not my ideas, and that's not an accident either. You know, it's just, I think that may be changing a little. I hope so. But just to say sharing ideas, well, that doesn't go very far. That's, you know, what ideas there are. The dominant ideas, they will be on offer and the other ones won't. They'll have all the money behind them and so forth. So, but to me, the question of technology is, does it allow community, actual face-to-face working community, and does it allow for a healthy ecological life space for species on this planet, not only ours, but others? And it doesn't. The more technology we have, the worse it gets. You know, that's a very wild, broad statement, but, you know, look at how it's going. Where's the happy horizon? You know, Enlightenment said, well, we'll have science and technology and we'll get rid of superstition and we'll solve every problem. Well, those things have failed utterly, just sadly. There's you just have to have an ideologue like Steven Pinker to assert the contrary, and he looks ridiculous trying to do it. He really does. So where is the how is it fixing everything? You know, where is that happening? What is the overall trend?
30 seconds left, John.
The air is more unbreathable now than ever. In all of these very advanced cities, the air in London is worse than that in Beijing. This happened time and time again in 2017. London, the peak of civilization, and the air is getting to be as poisonous as anywhere else. I mean, come on, it's sharing ideas. What the hell? What ideas are those? It's the same old stuff, the same old racket that is not fixing anything.
Okay, I think we got to turn it over to Andrew now in the sake of time. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, I find it interesting that we're talking about sharing ideas as being a negative thing when John's ideas are something we're talking about and we're sharing ideas right now, and that's one of the advantages of civilization, right? So responding to community, I think community actually is a trade-off as well, because if we have a large global civilization, you have connectivity through the internet and things like that, and that's not the same type of connection, obviously, but it gives you flexibility. So I could, if I get ostracized from my hunter-gatherer tribe, I die, basically. Like if I'm your crazy uncle who no one likes, or I, you know, get in a feud with someone over a woman or whatever it is, like I get ostracized from my tribe, I die in a hunter-gatherer society. I get outcast.
Well, no,
and I probably
the
die.
Actual mechanism is you go to another group, another society. You don't automatically die.
Well, assuming you can find one that will take you in, which is far from certain. But anyway.
In banned society, the people, if somebody's really toxic, maybe nobody wants them, and then maybe they would die.
Well, Today you can go off and make friends wherever you want. You can join a meetup group or something like that. You can meet new people. I mean, we met Julian on the internet. No, actually, we met in person.
But, we met at a children's birthday party.
I have many friends who I haven't met through the internet. That's true.
Don't ask.
That was community. Bad point there.
It sounds worse than it was.
Right. So addressing the air quality thing. So the air quality in London was far worse in the 1950s than it is today. We're actually improving air quality. No, so certain countries are not, like India and China, for example, because they're on a different part of that growth curve of energy production. And, you know, they rely on more coal and fossil fuels and things like that to produce their electricity, which is declining in Europe, especially in Europe, but actually in the United States as well. So I think that, you know, technology can be certainly destructive, but I think possibly less destructive than hunter-gatherer societies who strip the natural resources from the land and required us to become agricultural.
No, I have to say that's not a factual statement at all. Keep saying that.
And a lot of the other criticisms of community and violence and opioids and things like that, which are, you know, huge problems in the United States, are not as big problems as I think hunter-gatherers would have had. If you look at, we've argued about this before, but violent death rates and things like that, like the opioid crisis, the number of people who actually die from it is quite large. It's larger than gun violence, and it's a big problem, obviously. But it's far, far smaller than the number of people who would die every year in a hunter-gatherer society proportionally.
Well, again, you know, you've got to sort that out. You make these blanket statements. I mean, you know, we know that where suicide and mental illness really started, that's modern industrial mass society. There's a ton of literature on that.
Well, it's hard to say. I actually I'm not sure about that at all, because right now we have, you know, 7 billion people in the world. We have 300 million people. So we hear about large rates of mental illness, but I don't think it's certain that hunter-gatherers didn't have mental illness. And probably the ones that did just died. Like, if you had a problem in a hunter-gatherer society, you died, basically.
I don't know why you make these statements about how backward and stupid and they died instantly. All that stuff is really false.
I'm not saying backward and stupid. I think they were probably smarter than us. I think they were innovative, but they didn't have the ability to carry around, you know, people who weren't hunting and gathering, basically. So I think they were extremely smart, capable people. I think if I was transported back and I'm genetically identical to a hunter-gatherer, because you're right, we live 97% of our existence as hunter-gatherers. But if I was transported back and lost my memory, I would fit in with a hunter-gatherer. However, because I'm not equipped with the skills that they've learned, I would die.
Well, I can point you to evidence, fossilized evidence of millions of years ago where people were completely disabled. And we know that from the remains, lived long after they were totally disabled, okay? Because they were taken care of.
Well, it's possible.
These are Homo species.
Absolutely. If they're part of the family,
I'm thinking
that's
of 1.3 million years ago, okay? So they didn't just die because of this brutality and, you know, and stuff. That's just a kind of myth that civilization likes to say, because only we are enlightened and wonderful and share ideas and everything, even though everything is going to hell right before our eyes.
That's not what I'm saying at all, and I don't think everything's going to hell, but absolutely. You could have had respected elders. You could have had members of the family who, you know, we have that today. Like, people have their grandmother come and live in their house, for example, and they take care of them today.
We have way less than that. You know, in Japan, it's, well, anywhere in the modern world, the family unit is much more broken down and isolated. People are three times more apt to live alone than they were just 20, 30 years ago. I mean, we're just getting more and more atomized. All these organic units are breaking down, and they've had their problems too. I'm not saying every family or every group is wonderful, but, you know, when you see this kind of atomization, that's just part of the disappearance of community.
That's true. Actually, there is a disappearance of community. China passed a law where children are now required to visit their parents on a regular basis, once per year, I think, something
wow.
like that. Yeah. No, there is. There absolutely is. But what I'm saying is, community is not the panacea that I think you make it out to be, because lack of community gives you flexibility and allows you to go and meet new people. Maybe I don't like my family. Maybe I'm ostracized from my family because I'm different from them. I don't agree with their views. I can now go out in the internet and meet new people.
Okay,
I can create a new family of friends. So I think
I'm not denying it. Yeah, but we have choices. I mean, yeah, I'm not saying, I don't mean to think that everything is as awful as you think life outside of civilization. I see your point. Yeah, we all take advantage of all kinds of things, including me. I mean, I'm no different. You know, we probably like some of the very same things and operate in, you know, similar ways. I'm not saying that.
So it sounds like, you know, what I'm hearing you guys say agriculture and civilization creates a support system for more people to exist. It allows the population to sustain itself a lot easier, and it also gives people more options. It allows them to be more self-sufficient. It gives them more time for leisure to do things that they want to do, take further risk. I think it's fair to say there's a lot more risk you can take in a modern world than you could as a hunter-gatherer. Because it's just like life is safer, maybe. But I think that there's an environmental risk. There's an environmental trade-off with civilization and technology. And so there's all this talk about technology being able to offset its own environmental cost. How do we know it's actually going to be able to do that? And let's turn this over to Andrew first, and then John will let you respond.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think that John would definitely agree right now with I think 7 billion people in the world, we couldn't support them as hunter-gatherers. And I think that's fundamentally an environmentalism issue. Basically, there aren't enough fish in the rivers, and there aren't enough animals in the land, and there aren't enough, you know, gathering
right, is more,
you know, to support the people. And I think that and John disagrees with this, that I think that's one of the reasons that civilization came about. It's a Faustian bargain to support more people. It's kind of an evolutionary trend. To support more people, we adopted the methods that could support more people because there were more people and we were stripping the land. So first of all, I think civilization went hand in hand, that creation of civilization went hand in hand with environmental damage, basically. And there's no doubt that technology creates more environmental damage. And we have a lot of problems in that area today. I definitely don't disagree with that. I do think there are technological solutions to them. And I think the environmental damage we're doing per capita today is probably less than we were doing, you know, before. We've reformed some of our ways, and we haven't gone nearly enough far enough. But, you know, CFCs now are no longer depleting the ozone layer, and the ozone layer has recovered.
Not over cities, it hasn't. It's getting worse over cities.
I don't think that's true. We're no longer burning coal as much as we were. Coal is declining as an energy source in the developed world, at least. Wind power is now the largest renewable source of energy. In the United States, accounting for 7.5% of our electricity. So we will improve over time. Electric cars, you know, here's a big one, vegetarianism. I actually think people all in the future will eat, meat that's grown in labs. So, and I think John would actually find this abhorrent, but I think that basically the solution right now, we have this industrial food system that pollutes the land. We have, you know, half our country usable farming land taken up by, growing crops to feed animals, and then you lose 90% of the energy by growing the crops and feeding them to the animals instead of eating the crops directly, right? So like the most important thing you can do as an individual to save the planet is become vegetarian. That's absolutely true. But the solution to that is, you know, to find ways to that people will accept that, basically. And you can't just tell people to go and eat vegetables and what's more like legumes and stuff like that. You have to give them alternatives, and that comes about through technology. And so if you can produce a synthetic meat that is that has very little environmental impact, people will eat that.
Before we get too deep into that, I want to explore one more thing from Andrew's perspective that we didn't get to touch on. How do we know technology is actually going to be able to offset its own environmental cost? You know, like you were talking about vegetarianism and things like that, and I think that's really good. But in terms of like, you know, renewable energy and things like that and solar energy, you know, these things still have an environmental cost. You're still taking resources from the earth to create these things first and foremost. And then you still have to, you know, a lot of people are driving electric cars because they think it's good for the environment and it is fewer emissions, but you still, electricity is still fossil fuels in most places. So, you know, how do we know technology is actually going to be able to offset its own cost?
You just one thing, and I'm happy to go on with what you just said, Julian. But you know, this keeps getting repeated. We got more people, therefore we need domestication. Well, it's the other way around. The domestication caused the more people. Okay, we know that. That's when the population. You can't go around and say, "Well, we have all these people." Well, why? What is driving that? What caused that? Okay. Just to correct.
Well, I don't agree with that, actually. I think it goes hand in hand. It's like evolution. So you're right that you create a need for agriculture when you have more people, but more people creates a need for agriculture at the same time. It's synergistic. You can't separate
it's more
those
the
two.
Other way around.
I don't agree. I think it's entirely synergistic.
That's what drives the population, domestication. you don't have all these people out of nowhere. And then, oh, now we need domestication. No, it's really, in fact, you know, it's the other way around.
I don't know about that, because you have like Aborigines in Australia, for example, and they start to adopt technology and agriculture. Hunter-gatherers, when exposed to agriculture, adopt it always. So they're looking for ways.
That's another misnomer. This is usually, in fact, historically or prehistorically, if you will, this was a huge battle. There was a gigantic resistance. It wasn't like, oh, what a wonderful idea. Why didn't I think of that? How brilliant. Let's start farming. No, there was gigantic opposition. Stanley Diamond called it a titanic struggle.
So let's stick to the question of how do we know technology is actually going to be able to offset its own environmental cost?
I think John thinks we don't. In fact, I think John thinks it won't.
Okay, so but
no,
what about
not. It won't.
But what about you, Andrew? What
well,
do you...
I think we don't actually know.
Don't know.
I think it will. I'm hopeful that it will, but I acknowledge that there are, you know, it's a race, essentially. It's a race to see if we can develop technologies fast enough to basically offset our destructiveness. But the thing is, it's not a race we choose. I mean, we're kind of in this situation not by some decision we made, but by accident. And I think John's view that we should, you know, go back to some primitive existence really isn't any kind of solution. And when you distill it down, it really is the control that he's trying to avoid.
We're on a suicide path.
Okay, well, so there's two separate things. Will technology destroy us? And then the other thing is, how would we go about removing the technology, right?
Right.
So removing the technology, like going back to a primitive existence, how would we do that? And I know maybe not having a solution doesn't mean there's not a problem. But anyway, so the only way to go back, because basically it's this Faustian bargain that we're stuck with, right? And the only way to go back to a primitive existence and get rid of all the technology is the very control that John is trying to avoid, that he's ascribing to civilization.
In what way?
You have to take away people's technology because people love their technology. People like being able to go to the grocery store. I mean, maybe it's bad for them, but people do things that are bad for them all the time. But, you know, eating white bread and all these unhealthy foods that are produced by our commercial industrial agriculture, they like these things.
Yeah, junk food tastes good.
Yeah, junk food tastes good. I mean, maybe they're addicted to them. Maybe they're not healthy for them. That's
I don't personally eat a lot of it, well, but right, a lot of people, they don't have any qualms
right,
with
Coca-Cola,
it.
Coca-Cola, I mean, they're all throughout our entire civilization,
well, that's
actually.
That's a good point. That's a fundamental problem, a mammoth problem. Yeah, if people want all this stuff, if they want the techno world, then we are stuck with it. I don't know if people are going to stay stuck with it. I don't think it's all that satisfying when you look at the kind of the pathological emotional state that's really pretty darn common among the most, quote, developed countries. I'm not so sure at all if people are going to stick with it, but they might. They might just take more drugs and never mind how empty things are. They don't really have any connections with other people. Yeah, it's conceivable.
So but, let's
you know,
take
if
that
you're
pathological
talking about
state
the
you're
technological
talking
about. Solution, for example, let's just, well, just quickly,
sure.
Alternative energy. I won't even get into the stuff about how toxic a lot of it is, like solar, unbelievably toxic to build those panels, and then what happens when they burn out, and what about the huge industrial infrastructure to move that energy for production and consumption. You know, that's usually left out of the equation. But my question is even more fundamental, and that is, why do we want to have energy to keep doing stuff that we probably shouldn't have been doing in the first place? Why are we stuck on this rat's treadmill of, which is just not paying off? There's no question that we just have to have the energy, got to replace the coal and stuff with something else. Really? Why? And, you know, moving to something like a forager society or, you know, a hunter-gatherer society, I'm not saying that's, I don't even know if it's possible, but I think we have to figure out some process or get to work on some transition that goes in that direction. It doesn't just blindly accept, well, we need more science, we need more technology. That's the wrong direction. And whether we're going to figure it out or not, well, maybe not. And maybe people don't want to figure it out, you know, like you were saying, you know, people... But I think maybe they will. Maybe they'll sense that we're losing all too much. We're losing really everything.
You could say that the existence of junk food and mass-produced like stuff that people don't really need is there to kind of create, you know, like you said, there isn't enough food on the planet for 7 billion people. So in a way, we kind of have to create a bunch of junk that people can consume to keep them.
Well, it doesn't have to be junk food. So I think a lot of these problems that we're talking about, a lot of these problems that we're talking about are not problems of civilization so much as American society. I think these are critiques of American society. If you look at Scandinavia, for example, or Canada, to some extent, I'm from Canada. These don't have a lot of the social problems. They don't have the opioid crisis. They have far lower suicide rates. They don't have gun violence, essentially, at all on almost any scale. They have more social connection. I mean, they have like paternity leave. In Scandinavia, you get a year paternity leave to bond with your child. Paternity. And then you also, in Canada right now, you get 18 months of maternity leave.
Wow.
So, like, well, I went on vacation and
there are differences. I'm not trying to cram everything together and it's all just one monolithic thing. No, of course not. There are significant differences.
There are issues, absolutely, with extreme capitalism. But I think capitalism is overall a good thing that has brought prosperity to the majority of the world. I mean, income has been rising for the poorest of the poor. I mean, people living on $1 or $2 a day has dramatically declined since the 1960s, even.
Yeah, and you're saying that's just unblemished wonderfulness that they become consumers and part of mass society. I don't think that's, you've got to go a little deeper than that. Well, I mean,
I think you're ascribing more despair than actually exists.
There are places, I've been in India three times, and this may be surprising to anyone, including me, but, you know, when they talk about wiping out the slums, there was a huge opposition because they had community. They didn't have much money at all. But they didn't want to live in some antiseptic housing development for the poor kind of thing at all. And you could say, well, their standard of living is so poor. Well, yeah, so were Native people. Their standard of living was nothing compared to ours. But that's certainly not the only way to compute happiness or whatever.
No, I mean, it's not. Happiness is completely uncorrelated from that. Absolutely. But people vote with their feet, and that's the reason why people try to get into countries like Scandinavia and America. It's why we have, you know, people come across the border, illegal immigrants, because people think life is better in developed worlds. And I think that actually is true.
Relatively, it
does correlate with happiness to some extent, you know, maybe like $50,000 a year, something like that. Happiness increases, but after that, it doesn't. Money doesn't buy happiness, but to a certain extent, it does. If you are in squalor, then you are less happy, actually.
Well, squalor. What about, you could say, well, look at those Indians. They live in squalor. They don't have air conditioning.
That's different. No, it's being able to provide for yourself. And if you're a hunter-gatherer, successful hunter.
Maybe we live in squalor because we just have this empty consumer life full of technology and its promises that never seem to work out.
It's being able to provide for yourself. If you're a successful hunter-gatherer, then I would definitely not say you're living in squalor.
Yeah, most people living in a civilized lives are not self-sufficient.
You know, what we're seeing is a massive de-skilling of people in general in modern mass society, right? What we're really good at is staring at screens over 10 hours a day and working the buttons. But when all that dies, when all that goes away, what the hell are we going to do now? We won't know the first thing about surviving.
You're right, there's a shift.
And I don't just mean survival skills. I mean, people used to build things. They knew how things work. It's alarming to me how much that's just disappeared.
I don't think that's really true. I mean, we build things a lot. I think that there's lots of people who do have skills, and skills shift over time. That's creative destruction. As you shift from one industry to the next.
Yeah, now we have techno skills. We have virtual skills.
What's wrong? There's more computer programming. If you have a computer programming degree, you can get a job almost anywhere.
Yeah.
We import them en masse from India and the rest of the world.
That's not a skill at all, is it?
How can you argue that computer programming is not a skill on the technology?
If I can say something, I see technology as like compounded human knowledge. Like, you know, the thing we're able to look at screens all day now because we have we're building off of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of technology building, and so life has gotten easier. And I don't really know where that takes the discussion, but I'll let you guys.
Well, could I comment on that?
Sure.
You know, that's the thing about technology. That's the other, maybe it's the elephant in the room, right? We know where it comes from, but it's almost never mentioned. You've got to have millions and millions of people in the mines and the assembly lines and the smelters and the warehouses for some of us, especially white middle-class people, do have the luxury to stare at the screen all day, right? And, you know, some of these people that say they're radicals, that they want some kind of liberation, or, you know, they want a utopia of the left or something like that, they still want all those people stuck in that kind of misery and drudgery where they don't have the time or the energy to think interesting thoughts about sharing ideas, okay? If you don't have that, you don't have the technology. It depends on that level, not only of human misery, but of course the systematic destruction of the natural world. Yeah, can you answer that?
Sure. Technology and the global economy also creates opportunities for people to move themselves out of those very problems
You're ignoring what I just said. You can't answer the question, can you? That millions of people have to be doing the shit work so we can, you know.
Millions of people have always done shit work. The pyramids were built probably by people.
Hunter-gatherers didn't do shit work. They didn't do shit work.
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a value judgment that is not necessarily true.
In fact, they didn't do very much relatively. Didn't do very much work at all.
I think that's highly debatable. I think that in times of plenty, that's probably true that they could sit around eating berries and, you know, hunting the animals that happen to come by. But
civilization always means more work. Isn't that amazing?
Well, it means competition, which brings out the best in us.
More
and
work.
Is the fundamental
the
basis of all our achievements. I mean,
what achievement?
It depends on what your fundamental goal is.
Okay, let's explore one last topic, and then we're gonna call it quits after this.
I'd like to respond in more detail to that very point of inequality.
Can you do it in like 90 seconds?
Sure. Yeah. So you're right that our global system currently does create inequality. So inequality, I think, is not necessarily fundamentally bad. If you have an innovation that makes the poorest of poor slightly better off, assuming you account for all externalities, including environmental, something that makes the poorest of the poor just the tiniest bit better off, but makes the richest of the rich much better off, that's actually a net positive, not a net negative. There's nothing fundamentally that's a problem about inequality in itself, as long as everyone's life is improving. The only problem is you find everyone's life is not improving. And that happens. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. But that is a criticism of capitalism, not of civilization. There are many civilizations who are not as ultra-capitalist, and everything in life is a balance. And we're talking about social democracies and Scandinavia and stuff. They don't have that level of inequality.
Yeah, it's a trade-off, right? When indigenous people are, when their lifeways are destroyed, and then we replace it with, well, how much are you earning? They didn't think about it in those terms, did they? They didn't think about it in consumer terms. And am I relatively poor or less poor? That wasn't even a concept, was it? I mean, that's not, you ask a Native American, there are differences of opinion there too. Some of them are okay with all of that going away. Some of them are not. And historically, these people that are pushed off the land, well, they might be making more money now. Well, they were pushed off the land. That's the part you're supposed to forget.
So the poorest of the poor are far better off today than they have ever been in the history of the world, possibly excluding hunter-gatherers. However,
how much money you have is the value of a life, or the meaning of a life, or happiness, or community.
Well, able to keep yourself alive, I think, is a very important source of value.
Yeah, in this cutthroat world, which you assume will be eternal, and you'd like to have it be eternal, but that's not the world I want to have be eternal. And of course, people, refugees, obviously, that's a relative choice, isn't it? If it's really horrible somewhere else, and then you might dream of having a shit job in Europe or somewhere, well, that's better than what you had before, where you're being killed or something. But that's, what is that, the choice? I mean, that's a hideous choice. You have to choose between cancer and a heart attack or something, right? But what choices are those? That's not the perspective that I think is have much to do with the real quality or a real future.
I think this is a good time to jump into our last topic of discussion. So one thing I keep hearing repeated is how busy civilization keeps people, and how much work it creates for people. That's one thing that we've talked about a lot the last 10 minutes. I keep hearing John say that in response to you, Andrew, when you're talking about progress and things like that. So I guess Yeah, John, what's your perspective on civilization and how busy it keeps people, and what's that picture look like for you?
There's a really cool and really funny piece that's one of my favorites called The Original Affluent Society. Goes way back. Marshall Solins, anthropologist Marshall Solins, wrote it. And he really, I won't go through it, but the punchline kind of is, if your needs are being met, you're affluent. If your needs are not being met, you're not affluent, even if you own a mansion. Or the other way around, even if you own almost nothing, you're affluent if your needs are being met. You can't really compare two different kinds of things very easily. And what he points out, and he doesn't develop this, I'm not even totally sure why this is true, but he points out along the way, he says, civilization is always more work. You know, there are probably variations or blips up and down or whatever, but isn't that amazing? More and more technology means more and more work. Weren't we supposed to be liberated by technology? You know, it just hasn't worked that way. And not just in the U.S., where both adults, if it's a two-adult family, they both work now. When I was a kid, only the father worked, right? I mean, if we're just strictly talking about work, the quantum of work, it's really a failure of civilization that it always means more work.
And John, what about your perspective on civilization keeping people busy from a point of control? I'm assuming that's probably a different answer.
Well, keeping people busy, yeah. I mean,
because you guys were talking about the poorest of the poor and how the pyramids were built with like the lowest class and things like that. And so, like, I figured that you would have something interesting to say about that.
Well, people, yeah, that's the Neolithic, the beginnings of civilized life. It was characterized by monumentalism, right? From the whatever it is, the pyramids you mentioned and so forth. Yeah, that's when people become slaves. I mean, and literally and not so figuratively. Yeah, it's just everything changes. The entire logic, the entire trajectory is set on a course. And we see, I think, more easily all the time what it really brings, where we're going, and what is the real cost. I think it's just a tragic picture, and it's got to change fundamentally, or I don't know what is going to survive, you know, in some even a minimally healthy way. I just wonder. I think, well, there got to be some good stuff on the horizon, right? In some basic way. Well, I don't know what it is. You know, let's see what it is. You know, within civilization, that ain't the way it's playing out.
All right, Andrew, what about you?
Yeah, I think John and I agree on some basics, but I think that maybe we're exaggerating the negative aspects of civilization and downplaying the negative aspects of being a hunter-gatherer. So I think a lot of these problems that we say are caused by competition, which I think is a fundamentally good thing that brings out the best of our nature. It creates incentives to achieve things.
Struggle is growth, survival is evolution.
Well, right. Yeah, basically. I think that people's needs are being met better today than they ever have been before in the entire world. And this is, so we have to draw a distinction here between present civilization and previous civilizations, where I think you could definitely make that argument, and between present civilization and hunter-gatherers or primitivism, where it's sort of unclear. I think, though, that the data is disputed whether people are better off as hunter-gatherers. I don't think it's true that people worked, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day. And it is true that they do that in some hunter-gatherer societies. But we've got a small sample right now of data to work with. And so it's unclear how long people actually did work. The thing is, I think it comes down to choice. We have a lot more choices today. And, you know, if you want to go off and live in a cabin in the woods, I think you actually can do that today in North America. John lives in Oregon, and you can kind of, you know, escape a little bit. So I think you can, if you want to, disconnect. So you have that choice. And people generally don't actually take that choice.
How can you say that? You know, they used to say that about I remember the PC stuff at the beginning of the 80s, and some of us were talking about that. And I would always get this response, well, if you don't like it, don't buy one. It's a free choice. Well, really? How fast was it that it was absolutely mandatory in schools? You have to have email. I could sit in a cave somewhere. What choice is that? Come on. You can't. I'm not happy. I have a radio show and it streams live around the world. I'm not happy being in that situation, but I could be at a total disadvantage if I only wanted to write letters and never use the never go online. Yeah, but then that's not a choice.
But there's not some controlling force behind this. It's because people en masse, each person makes an individual decision which contributes to the whole, and we have decided as a civilization that email gives us some benefit. It saves us time. I love email. I hate fax machines. I hate the landline telephones. Like, what? Why would it? I hate regular mail. It just drives me crazy when someone, you know, says, oh, okay, mail this in and expect a response in like 2 weeks. And yeah, maybe I'm brainwashed a little bit from, you know, the benefits of civilization, but it's actually convenient. I like it. I enjoy work. I mean, people have hobbies. You have more freedom now to pursue your hobbies. If you want to go camping, you want to go rock climbing, you can do that. And I know I'm painting a picture from the perspective of someone living in a Western civilization, but the reality, and a lot of people are miserable, but I think people have pretty much always been miserable a little bit. Like, civilization is not... Well, right. We can argue...
We're just being cut off from everything. Look at handwriting. They're not even teaching handwriting because you'll just be tapping at the computer all day, all of your life.
Why is that a bad thing?
And now, I just read this yesterday, now they're even taking away signatures from like checks or
excellent
credit cards.
They're completely unnecessary.
Even that is disappearing. What? Even that personal part of life.
But why is
your
that
own
a bad
handwriting,
thing?
Your own signature. That's and you think that's a wonderful thing?
Yes,
the technology
absolutely
just abolishes
it's convenient.
All that kind of fabric and variety.
Yes,
I don't.
Sure,
that's the brave new world.
That's what
that
happens. Technology moves on. It's creative destruction. We abandon coal to go to natural gas. I mean,
yeah. It's been so great for species and the environment, hasn't it? It's been a catastrophe.
Okay, let's. I think we've got to.
It's been great for 7 million people. I mean,
we've got to wrap this up.
Anyway,
no, it's not. No, it's not. I mean, why do you say that? It's great for you. You think? I mean, relatively. And I've got a privileged life too. I'm not in the coal mines or any mines.
No one should be in the coal mines these days because we shouldn't be using coal.
Well,
exactly the argument with coal. We should be transitioning to other technologies and retraining people as computer programmers because that's creative destruction. That is how society changes over time.
Okay, we've got to wrap this up. Let's do a close. I want to hear each of you do a closing statement. John, why don't you start?
I think we covered it. I think we just be repeating ourselves,
well,
frankly.
I want to hear you say one more thing, John. I think it would be good for us each, like, you know, just take 60 seconds each. John, why do you think we should, just in a nutshell, you know, your concerns, 60 seconds, go for it.
Every civilization heretofore has collapsed, has failed, and this one, the last one left, is doing a grand job of self-destructing. And it's an illusion to think this is any different because they're all driven by the same inner logic, which is domestication, which is control, exploitation, always more control in every single respect in terms of the earth, in terms of the land, in terms of surveillance, in terms of everything. Don't have a happy ending. The only happy ending is to get rid of it and get back to freedom and eros and taking what nature gives instead of ruining the planet in the race to exploit everything and even to go to other planets to exploit them.
And John, if you could just clarify what leaving that behind looks like.
Well, that's just the tallest question. That's just the big one. I don't have an easy answer for that. You know, if we're just going to stay addicted and dependent and de-skilled, it gets worse and worse. It probably gets harder. But at the same time, I think there are people that are beginning to think, well, hey, this is kind of a mess, isn't it? My kids, it's going to be even worse for them. How is it not going to be worse for them? Is there going to be mass shootings twice a day now instead of just every other day? Or, you know, is everyone going to be shooting up and dropping dead from junk and ethanol and all the rest of it? Or do you think there's some happy tomorrow? Just more civilization and more technology will just bring the wonderful day. Nope, it's not working out that way. It's obvious that it's failing.
All right, Andrew, why don't you give us your closing thoughts?
Sure. Throughout history, people have always predicted the doom of the planet, the earth, whatever, the end of humanity. We're going to hell in a handbasket. And that's just not true. People are better off today than they ever have been before in the history of the world. Technology creates freedom for people. And any attempt to go back to some kind of primitive existence necessarily relies on control. You have to take away people's technology somehow, and you have to force the world back from 7 billion people down into a hunter-gatherer society of 10 million people, maybe, the carrying capacity of Earth. I think technology is what created science. Civilization is what created science. It is the most powerful tool we've ever invented. It allows us to be introspective about our place in the universe, understand truth, what the universe really is, why we're here. Actually, we don't really know why we're here, but what our place is in the universe and what it all, you know, what this existence really is. It's understanding. Instead of having hunter-gatherer myths around the campfire explaining nature, we can actually try to understand nature. And I think there's a lot of value to that. And I think there's a lot of value to having a lot of people sharing ideas and contributing to that and being part of the human story. Before, you know, hunter-gatherers wouldn't have known there's people in China or India or, you know, around the world, and we're connected to them. There is a trade-off. Civilization is a trade-off. Technology is a trade-off. There's downsides. And I think that the difference between John and myself are really just how we put our fingers on the scale and measure how that trade-off comes out. And I think I see a lot more benefits to civilization and technology than John does. And I think he sees a lot more benefits to a primitive existence, I guess.
Do you think we had it best as hunter-gatherers? Do you think it was best when we were farmers? Or do you think we have it best now that we get all of our food from Amazon Prime? We're going to turn it over to the listeners. We want to know what you think about this. Leave a comment with your thoughts. Involve yourself in the conversation, because that's what this whole podcast is about. Leave a comment. YouTube is a great place to do that. Or if you want to send me something longer, you can shoot me an email, hello@spellboundshow.com. I'd love to hear from you. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. That way your phone will always stay up to date. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. Hope you're enjoying it as much as I am. And I will see you guys next Monday. Unless civilization ends before then. But it probably won't.